Okay, so good morning, welcome back to class number two of Ezra Nehemiah, and maybe we'll actually read more than a pasuk today, but I'm not sure. I want you to know, the more I prepare this class, the more excited I become, because it's so rich and it's so deep, and there's so many different layers to it. So I don't even know that we'll, you know, I thought maybe we'd take a couple months, but this really might, we might go the whole year on this. And I'm super excited about it. So what I want to do today is go on a little bit of a tangent, which we're going to do a bunch of times, and you'll forgive me for that, but you'll understand how it all connects. Let's review for just a brief second a little bit of our timeline. Okay, the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed in what year? 586. Okay, 586 BCE. And when does Cyrus give the permission for the Jews to come back to Eretz Yisrael in the year, well, 70 years later, it's not, yeah, enough of 70 years. Let's say between 538 and 536, okay, is when Zerubbabel and Yoshua, remember who we said are the two leaders, and they're leaders for good reasons. Zerubbabel, we know, is linked directly to the Davidic dynasty. Yoshua also is going to be a significant personality, which again, we're not even going to get to them yet this week. And we'll see in a second, there's a third person, Sheshbatzar. We don't really know who he is, but those are the first three people. And they are the original group who comes on the Aliyah. That's the 42,360 that we referenced last week. When we talk about Ezra, he does not appear on the scene for a number of years. So for example, again, according to the timeline that we're working on, Ezra doesn't come until 458. So they're already there for a number of years before Ezra, and Nehemiah is going to come even after Ezra arrives. And until then, what are you going to have? So again, you're going to have Zerubbabel, you're going to have Yoshua, and who else? You're going to have Mordechai and Esther are also going to be the leaders. Just to give you a little bit of a sense of a timeline, Mordechai and Esther, according to the timeline that we're going to work off of, is somewhere in the years of 483 to 473. So again, it's after the period of Zerubbabel, Yoshua, it's after Koresh has already given permission for the Jewish people to return to Eretz Israel, and it's before Ezra Nehemiah, clumped in the middle there. And again, in future weeks, we will elaborate on that timeline a little bit more. For our purposes this morning, let's stick with the simple. Okay? Beis HaMikdash is destroyed in the year 586. Who are the Nevi'im that are prophesizing about the Beis HaMikdash? So we know Yirmiyahu, most famously. Now, where is Yirmiyahu during the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? For the majority of it. He's in Yerushalayim, right? When Yirmiyahu, again, we're going to assume for simplistic purposes right now, that Yirmiyahu is the one who writes Eicha. Okay, maybe yes, maybe no, but we're going to assume yes for now. Yirmiyahu is writing Eicha from what perspective? He's in Yerushalayim, right? Eichaya, Shvab, Adad, Ha'ir, right? He's writing about a city that is desolate. Okay, so he's writing from the perspective of living Yerushalayim. There's another Navi that is predominantly prophesizing about that time period. Mali referenced it, and that is Yechezkel. Now, Yechezkel's prophecies are fundamentally different than Yirmiyahu's prophecies. And the reason why his prophecies are fundamentally different is because he is not writing from inside Yerushalayim, but rather he is writing from outside. He is sent into exile in the first exile. And so all of his prophecies are coming from Bavel, from Babylonia, which obviously gives a unique and different perspective, different than the one that you're going to experience in Yirmiyahu. Now, most of the time when we talk about the Chorban, we think in terms of Yirmiyahu. We study Yechezkel a lot less frequently than we do Yirmiyahu. So who was Yechezkel? Yechezkel's prophecies run 22 years, from the year 593 all the way until 571. So again, basically, he's writing before the Chorban until 15 years after the Chorban. Now, as opposed to Yirmiyahu, Yeshayahu, maybe Ovadia and some other of the Nevi'im who are writing from within Eretz Yisrael, Yechezkel is writing from the vantage point of Galus. The other thing that's important to understand about Yechezkel, again, just a little bit of a background, is that Yechezkel is written chronologically. So, for example, the first 24 chapters of Sefer Yechezkel are writing about pre-Chorban. It's writing about previous to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Yechezkel is offering prophecies. And again, those prophecies are encouraging Bnei Yisrael to do tshuva. It's warning them about the pending destruction. It's sensitizing them to what life will look like in Galus, etc. The last 15 chapters, from 38 to 48, are all writing from the vantage point of after the Chorban. Okay, so whenever you're learning Sefer Yechezkel, it's important for you to realize, or I'll put it differently, when you're reading a Haftorah from Yechezkel, okay, because that's really when we learn. We don't learn Navi otherwise, except for this class, but really when we read the Haftorahs, so you have to know within the context of what's Yechezkel talking about. Is this pre-Chorban? Is this prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? Or is it after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? Okay, so we have Yechezkel, 22 years, pre-Chorban, post-Chorban. Why am I talking about Yechezkel? Didn't we say that this was going to be a class of Ezra and Nehemiah? Well, not really. Because if you remember the last week, anyone not here last week? Ooh, okay, sorry. So those who were here last week know that while we're going to specifically focus on the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, the truth is that Ezra and Nehemiah are political books. And we'll see this fleshed out more and more as we study. Okay, Koresh is a non-Jewish king who is giving permission to the Jewish people to return to Yerushalayim to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? As this is all going on, though, there are Nevi'im that are prophesizing and offering a different perspective. So as I referenced last week, while we're officially learning Ezra and Nehemiah, what we're really learning about is Shivat Zion, which means the return of the Jewish people to Zion, to Zion, after the exile of Babel, after Galus Bayis Rishon, the first exile of the first Beis HaMikdash. And one of the things we touched upon last week, and I want to flesh out a little bit more, is just how unreasonable and how unimaginable the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are. So again, Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, again, for our intents and purposes, 586. Okay? Koresh gives them permission to come back to Yerushalayim in 538, 536, somewhere around there. What I want to do today is to help you understand just how inexplicable that series of events is. Because anyone who has learned the book of Malachim with us last year knows how bleak the situation was as we come close to the Chorban, as we come close to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and how unimaginable it was to the Jewish people when Yirmiyahu prophesizes that, don't worry, 70 years later, you're going to return back to Yerushalayim. That seemed completely implausible. Okay? Now, to help you understand that, just how unreasonable it is, because again, you can't understand the euphoria of Ezra and Nehemiah and how exciting it is unless you appreciate how unimaginable it is also. Okay, so picture yourself in any number of situations in life where if I simply give you something, right? So let's say I tell you in a vacuum, someone runs a marathon. Okay? Pretty good, right? Many people run marathons. 50,000 of them ran the New York City Marathon on Sunday. Lots of people do it. Okay? Nothing spectacular about that. But let's say I come along and tell you that there was someone who was morbidly obese, who couldn't walk from here to the couch without panting and needing oxygen, right? You get the vision. And that person, this last Sunday, ran the New York City Marathon. Whoa! Now, it's not just like, oh, one of 50,000 people who ran the marathon, but now it's like, wow, that's pretty impressive that that person ran the marathon. And you saw stories like that, right? There was an amazing story about a woman who a number of years ago was running away from an attacker, someone who was trying to sexually attack her. And in the process, she slipped off a cliff and she was paralyzed. That woman ran the New York City Marathon, ran, obviously with crutches, the New York City Marathon this past Sunday. Now that's like amazing. And you hear stories like that and it makes every other person seem unceremonious who ran the New York City Marathon, right? So once you appreciate the backdrop, how unreasonable, implausible the narrative is, when it actually happens, it makes it that much more special. So almost as a backdrop to Ezra Nehemiah, I want to share with you just how unreasonable the Jewish people felt it was that they would be returning back to Yerushalayim only 70 years later. And for this, I want to study a very famous Haftorah, well, it's really part of the Navi, but a Perek of Yechezkel, which we read as a Haftorah. And that is the Haftorah of the Dry Bones. Okay, when do we read the Haftorah of the Dry Bones? No. Shabbos, Chol HaMoed, Pesach. Now, if we were doing a Haftorah class, we would explore why we read this Haftorah in Shabbos. Chol HaMoed. We did that. A lot of them are online. Right? Why we read this on Shabbos, Chol HaMoed, Pesach. But forget that for now. You can discuss that at your Shabbos table this week. Okay? I want to read this Haftorah. And as we read this Haftorah, you'll see very clearly why we're reading this Haftorah. Because it both depicts the Jewish people's mindset when it comes to returning to Yerushalayim and Hashem's promise in doing so as well. We will be a little bit tangential because once you're learning this Haftorah or this Perek of Navi, you have to extrapolate it to contemporary situations as well. And of course, as I mentioned last week, the whole excitement of learning the books of Ezra Nehemiah is just how relatable they are to our day and age. And almost no class will go by where you won't come away saying, oh my goodness, that Navi was talking to us. That's our generation. And that's exactly what we're going to do this week. So if you open up the packet that I gave you to the book of Yechezkel. Now, of course, the dry bones are going to be an analogy to what? To us, to Bnei Yisrael, to how Bnei Yisrael felt, right? When you're dead, you don't exist anymore, you're dry bones. I don't need to build up the analogy, it's pretty self-evident, okay? But that's how Bnei Yisrael felt. Now, there is a little bit of a dispute amongst the Meforshim. Are we talking about Tchiyas HaMesim, the ultimate revival of the dead, or are we talking about returning to Yerushalayim after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, okay? We're going to ignore that for now because I'm going to use it. I'm going to assume that we're talking about our time period. And again, Yechezkel is talking about in between the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, before Bnei Yisrael are returned back in Koresh, those 70 years is where Yechezkel is prophesizing. And this will give us insight into the mindset of Bnei Yisrael. So let's read a little bit. Haisa ala yad Adonai. V'yotzieni beruach Adonai v'inicheni besocha beka v'hi mle'a atzamot. So God takes Yechezkel out, right? V'yotzieni beruach Adonai. Focus on that word. What's ruach? The Spirit of God, okay? And he places him in a valley, where that valley is, not really sure, maybe Bavel. V'hi mle'a atzamot. And it's filled with bones. V'evirani alehem saviv saviv. And God basically surrounds them with these bones. Vine rabot ma'od al pnei abika v'nehei yiveshot ma'od. And there are plenty of bones and they're very dry. Vayomer Eli, and God says to him, Ben Adam, hatechiena hatzamot ha'ele. Right? Can these bones ever come back to life? Now what's absurd about that question? So you're asking God to do, well, who's talking here? God is talking. Right? So God says, do you think these bones can ever be brought back to life? So Yechezkel responds, probably as any of us would respond. Va'omar, and I said, Adonai Elohim, Ataya Data. Right, right. What are you asking me for? You're God. How am I supposed to know? Right, you figure it out, God. Okay, you can do anything. Now, you're right in that the whole kind of groundwork to all this is just how absurd this is. Right? If you have a pile of dried bones, they don't come back to life. It's completely implausible. And it's specifically that implausibility which is the underlying narrative of this entire chapter. Okay? So Yechezkel says, God, I don't know. You tell me. By Yomer Eli, God says back to me, Hinave ala tzamos ha'ilu. Go give a prophecy about these bones. Ve'amarta alehem. And say to them, ha'tzamos ha'yeveshos. You dry bones. Shimu dvar Adonai. Listen to the words of God. Ko amar Adonai Elohim ha'tzamos ha'ilu. This is what God said to these bones. Verse 5. Hine ani mevi bachem ruach v'chisem. I'm going to bring you ruach. Again, I'm going to give you spirit. Now, where do we know that word from? Even before. Right? What is God? How does God create man? What does he blow into him? He blows ruach. He blows this, that same ruach into man. So that's give life. Okay? The ruach is always gives life. So Yechezkel says, I'm going to give you ruach, basically. I'm going to bring you back to life. V'nasati aleichem gidim. I'm going to give you sinews. Ve'aleisi aleichem basar. And afterwards, I'm going to give you flesh. Ve'karamti aleichem or. And then I'm going to put skin on you. Ve'nasati bechem ruach v'chisem. And then I'm going to blow into you and you're going to come alive. V'idatem ki ani Adonai. And you will know that I am God. Now, what's interesting about this prophecy so far? Right? How God has a lot of tricks in his book. Okay? What are any number of ways he could bring these bones back to life? He can go like this, and they can come back to life. Or he can do what's described here, which is that it's a process. It's stages. Okay? That's also going to be significant. Pasuk Zion, verse 7. So he prophesizes, Vayhi kol kinave, and all of a sudden, there's this sound, Vine rash, and there's a loud noise. Vatikrvu atzamos etzem, and each bone comes near. Turn the page. El atzmo. They start blending together. Okay, so you have all these disparate bones, and how do you form a body? Right, we know you have skeleton, so the bones gotta the left bone's connected to the right bone, right? So they all gotta come together. So that's exactly what's happening right now. Okay. Vara'isi v'nei aleim gidim ubasar ala v'yikra aleim or milamala v'ruach ein bahem. So everything happens. You have the sinews and you have the flesh and you have the skin. But what's missing? The ruach. Hey, now that's interesting, right? Vayomer Eli. So God comes back almost in a second prophecy, and he says, "Hinave ala ruach." Wait a second, you forgot the most important part. So you give a prophecy about the ruach. Hinave ben Adam ve'amarta el ruach ko amar nai Elohim me'arbaru chos bo'i, come from all different directions, right? V'yichiu, and then you're going to bring this to life. Ve'hinaveti kasher tzivani, I did exactly what God said, and sure enough, this ruach come. Verse 10. Ve'yamdu al raglehem chayil gadol me'od me'od, and they stood up on their feet, and they were big people again. Okay? Vayomer Eli, and God said to me, Ben Adam, Hatzamos Ha'elu, Ha'ela, Kol Beis Yisrael Hema. These bones are the Jewish people. Hine Omrim Yavshu Atzmosenu. Ve'avda Tikvatenu Nigzarnu Lanu. They said we are Yavish, we are dry, we are lifeless. Okay, we're withered. Okay, Rabbi Goldberg and I have this shtick that, right, we talk about a lulav. So a lulav ayavesh, a lulav can't be dry. It's pusil if it's dry. So we have this shtick that we get to a certain point in Sukkos where you're just like, you can't be creative anymore. We're done writing drushas. You've been in shul for like a month straight. You haven't seen your family. So there's always that text every year at some point which says, I'm a lulav ayavesh, right? Like, I'm done. Like, I can't be creative anymore. The juices aren't flowing. I'm a dried out lulav. So anyways, that's a Jewish people, right? Yavshu atzmosenu. We're dry. Okay? Ve'avda tikvatenu. And we have lost hope. Now that word is really interesting because where do we know that word from? Hatikva. Right? Think about the imagery that when they came back in the modern state of Israel, and they needed a biblical word to capture what it is that was happening. Hatikva wasn't just used because tikva means hope and it works. It's a specific biblical reference. The Jewish people felt avda tikvateni, that we had lost hope. And so what did the founders of the modern state of Israel do when they wrote Hatikva? They called it Hatikva. In other words, that hope has been renewed. It's an amazing usage of our exact text. Okay, so avda tikvateinu, the Jewish people felt that we've lost hope, that God has given up on us. Right? And for good reason, by the way. Because again, even if you didn't learn Malachim with us last year, and you just have a peripheral understanding of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, it's not unreasonable to believe that God gave up on the Jewish people, that there was a severance in the relationship between God and his people. Here you had God's home on this earth, the place where God connected to his people, a place where Chazal tell us there were multiple miracles that happened every single day which symbolized God's presence in our midst. And all of a sudden, God destroys it, or allows it to be destroyed. And if you're sitting there at that time, you're saying, what's going on? What's my relationship with God look like now? Has God given up on us as his people? Now, we're not the only people that felt that way. Who else will make us, or will remind us to feel that way? Specifically, right? Christians. What's the New Testament, right? It's an assumption that God has no longer, right? We were once, the Jews were once the chosen people, but after the destruction of not the first, but the second Beis HaMikdash, they'll argue that God no longer chooses the Jewish people, because if he did, why would he treat them that way? And so therefore, who are the new chosen people? The Christians. And that's why you have an Old Testament and a New Testament, okay, to symbolize that. What? Replacement theology, exactly.
Don't they say that's because we didn't accept Yashka? That's why I had a Christian that I work with who says, that's why the Jews lost.
Yeah, whatever the reason is, but clearly, right, we're not the first people to look at the sometimes challenged relationship between us and Hashem and to say, if you were the chosen people, why would God have just treated you this way? So says Yechezkel, this is exactly how the people themselves felt. If we're the chosen people, how did God treat us this way? It must be that God has abandoned us. Avda tikva seni. Now, when you read those words, I want you to understand, you can't read those words and still believe that within 70 years, God's going to bring you back to Yerushalayim and allow you to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Right? They're contradictory emotions. But that's exactly why I'm reading this, because I want to help you understand how it is B'nai Yisrael felt. Yud bet 12. Lachin hinaviva amarta lehem ko amar Adonai Elohim. Hashem says to Yechezkel, go, prophesize to them. Hine ani poseach es kivroseichem. I'm going to open up your graves. Ve'ha'aleisi eschem mikivroseichem ami. My people. Right? Ami. You're my people. I'm going to bring you up out of those graves. Ve'veisi eschem el admas Yisrael. And I'm going to return you to the land of Israel. Really, an emotional prophecy. Right? God is almost acknowledging how they feel and telling them, despite how you feel, Ami, you are my people, and I am going to return you, therefore, back to the land of Israel. Vidatem, ki ani Adonai, and you will know that I am God, pischei es kivroseichem, uba'alosi eschem mikivroseichem ami, when I do all this, when I return you to your land, you will then know that I am God. Menasati ruchi bachem. I am going to put my ruach into you. V'chi sem. And I'm going to bring you back to life. V'hinachti eschem alam ad maschem. I'm going to place you on your land. V'idatem ki ani Adonai dibarti v'asisi ni'uma Adonai. Not only do I say I'm going to do it, but I actually do it. I am Hashem, your God. What an amazing prophecy. One that we probably don't learn. We hear about the dry bones, but we don't really fully study it. Now, what immediately strikes you about this prophecy? So one is that, as was referenced earlier, that returning the people to Israel is no small feat, right? That's clearly what the Navi is trying to communicate to us. It uses the most implausible circumstance possible. Right? We say in English, when pigs fly, this parak is the equivalent of Hashem saying when pigs fly. Right? When bones come back to life. Okay? And that's exactly what happens. And Hashem uses that analogy to show that just as you think Trias HaMesim is impossible, so too you think your return to Eretz Yisrael is impossible, but it's going to happen. Okay, so Hashem uses the most impossible of feats. He compares it to the resurrection of dead to say that if you believe that Trias HaMesim can happen, which, by the way, we have to believe, it's one of the 13 principles of faith, then you also have to believe that no matter what the circumstances are, God can return us to the land of Israel. That's point number one. Point number two is the stages, right? Remember, there are the bones, the sinews, the skin, and only then the spirit. Okay, what clearly the Navi is communicating to us is that the redemption doesn't happen automatically. It's not going to happen instantly. Now, this obviously for us as 20th century Jews, 20th century, right? 21st, right? This resonates with us. Because if you go back to the first Zionist Congress in 1897, right? All the way until 2018, one thing that we know is that Geula doesn't happen overnight. That it's going to have ups and downs, and it's complex, and there's going to be challenges. Right, think about what the Jewish people have gone through over the last 120 years to get to the point that we are now. Even in after 1948, when many believe that this was going to be the, right, we say it every Shabbos, Reishit Smicha Gulatenu, that this is the beginning of the redemptive process, we're 70 years later, and we know that it hasn't always been smooth sailing. Okay, I was just in Israel. I referenced this last week at the GA, the General Assembly of Federations of North America, right? One thing that we know is that it's a little messy in Israel right now, right? You have conversion, you have the Kotel, you have a lot of challenges in Israel. So it hasn't always been a straight ride. It's been an up and down ride. Says Hashem, that's okay. That's how Geula is going to happen. It's what the Midrash refers to as kima kima, which means it's going to happen little by little, step by step. And that's the way it's going to happen. Now, for us, this is going to also be important because as I've referenced, everything that we're going to learn in our Navi is going to be applicable to the modern state of Israel. And everything we've experienced with the modern state of Israel, you're going to be able to read back into the Navi. So we know Yechezkel is telling us that it's going to be a slow, bumpy process. And we know that that's happened in contemporary times. What about Ezra and Nehemiah? So keep this point in the back of your mind. Because, and I promise you, eventually we'll learn Ezra and Nehemiah. But as we learn Ezra and Nehemiah, and it comes out with a punch, very first pasuk. Remember, we learned this last week again, and we'll review it this week. But Koresh says you can come back to land of Israel. Wow. Right? UN says you can have a state of Israel. Wow. And as we'll see, almost immediately, after Koresh allows the Jewish people to come back to Israel, there are bumps along the way. And every single challenge, I promise you, without fail, every single challenge that Ezra and Nehemiah are going to encounter, and again, we're not even up to Ezra and Nehemiah, that Zerubbabel and Yoshua are going to encounter, and ultimately Ezra and Nehemiah, are exact same challenges that we have faced in the last 70 years. Every single one. Enemies externally trying to stop it. Enemies internally trying to stop it. So what Yechezkel is describing here is almost to give chizuk to the Jewish people. To not lose faith. Don't lose faith that God has abandoned you and that God won't return you back. And even once it starts, don't lose faith as there are bumps along the road. Don't assume that just because it doesn't happen in an instant and smooth and perfect doesn't mean the Geula still won't happen. Doesn't have to be perfect. And again, that's going to be a theme that we're going to read throughout Ezra Nehemiah. Yeah, Ma.
What brings to mind immediately is those people in contemporary times,
Right, right. Yeah, so again, there are going to be those, and even we'll see in Ezra Nehemiah, there are going to be those that don't believe this is the redemption. There are going to be those who are cynical about it. They're going to, right? We're going to see all of these themes. I promise you, we'll see all of these themes. I want to point out a few more things just about this prophecy before we then transition a little bit to Ezra. Okay? Number one, what's the order of the revival of the bones? Right? So again, first you have the bones, the sinews, the flesh, and then you have the spirit. So you have the physical resurrection, and then the spiritual. This is very applicable to our day and age. Why? Because what is Yechezkel telling us? That there are really two elements to the return to Yerushalayim. There's a physical rebuilding of Yerushalayim, but then there's a spiritual component to it. Contemporarily, the most famous expression of this was by none other than Rav Kook. Rav Kook fundamentally believed that there were two stages to the redemption. That there was going to be a physical element to the redemption. You have to physically come back to land. You have to physically rebuild the land. You have to build towns and cities and highways and roads and military, etc. But there's also a spiritual component to this. When does Rav Kook, and those who come to any of my classes know I reference this all the time, when does Rav Kook most explicitly express this? Anyone remember? Right when he comes to Israel. Okay, when Rav Kook comes to Palestine, he comes just a few months before who dies in 1904? Herzl. Okay, Rav Kook comes a few months before Herzl dies in July, I believe it is, of 1904. Rav Kook is asked to eulogize Herzl. And as we've taught before, this is what's called being caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, if he does not eulogize Herzl to play toward his right-wing base, we'll call it, who didn't hold of Herzl, who felt that Herzl was he was a secular, but that felt that he was a threat to religious Judaism. So who does he then alienate? He alienates all of the pioneers, the secular pioneers, who he wants to bring in, who he wants to make feel part of the state of Israel. Well, Palestine, right? On the other hand, if he gives the eulogy for Herzl, and he plays to the secular, so what does he risk doing? Alienating all of the religious ones. So that's what he doesn't know what to do. And again, we have letters back and forth to his father-in-law, for example. What should I do? I'm not sure. And this was not a simple calculation for Rav Kook. There was a lot of vitriol on both sides. So what does he do? So he gets up there and he gives a eulogy where he does a number of things. Number one is he does not mention Herzl by name. Okay? Number two is he explains that there are two Mashiachs. There is a process of the Messiah. One is Mashiach ben Yosef, followed by a Mashiach ben David. And what Rav Kook says is the same way there's a Mashiach ben Yosef who precedes the Mashiach ben David, so too, he says, in our redemptive process, there's going to be two elements of it. Now, Yosef represents what? Right? When Yosef goes down to Egypt, what's his role? Physical, right? Yosef is preparing physically, remember, with the whole famine and collecting the food. That's all physical preparations for the Jews to come down to Mitzrayim. Who comes down to set up the yeshivas, so to speak? Yehuda. Okay? So says Rav Kook, that's exactly how the state of Israel is going to be rebuilt. There's going to be a physical component to it that's going to precede the spiritual component to it. And essentially what he says is, you, secular Zionists, Herzl, you are the Mashiach ben Yosef. Right? You are going to lay the physical groundwork for our return to Zion, for our return to Zion. But what happens to Mashiach ben Yosef? He dies to make way for Mashiach ben David. So you see what Rav Kook did, right? He gives credibility to the secular Zionists. He says, you're playing a role in the redemptive process. You're part of this process. But then what does he also do? As he says, but you got to, right? You're only part of the plan. Because there's going to be a second part, which is going to be the Torah, the spiritual revival of the Jewish people as well. Hey, that's what Rav Kook does magnificently. And again, he does it in a number of different places. For example, when Hebrew University opens up, Rav Kook gives a famous speech where, again, he outlines a similar philosophy. That philosophy is exactly what Yechezkel is telling the Jewish people here. Yechezkel is saying there are going to be stages to the revival of the Jewish people, to the return to Tzion. But how is it going to happen? First, there's going to be the physical component. There's going to be those who are going to come back and are going to physically build up the land. But it's incomplete unless you also have the Ruach Hashem. You also need the spiritual revival. Where again, if we were doing an entire textual study, here that really means Torah. Right? Torah is what gives us what we say, Chiyus, it gives us life. Kiyim Chayenu V'Orech Yameinu. Torah is what gives us life. So that's exactly, that two stages, the physical preceding the spiritual, is exactly what Yechezkel is describing here. Now, parenthetically, we're not going to read this, but the second half of this chapter is another very famous Haftorah. It's the Haftorah for Parshas Vayigash. And the Haftorah describes that there are two sticks. There's the stick of Yehuda, and there's the stick of Yosef. And the Navi describes how those two sticks are going to come together. And when they come together, what's going to happen? That's when the Geula is going to come. That's exactly what Rav Kook identifies as the formula for redemption. You have the Yosef, the physical. You have the Yehuda, the spiritual. And when those two come together, that is when redemption happens. Okay? Now, the other interesting thing to note about this process of the redemption that Yechezkel outlines is that he states explicitly that you have a lot of these bones, and what happens to the bones? Vatikrevu atzamot etzem el atzmo. Which is a nice way of saying that all the disparate bones, all the right, picture hundreds of thousands of bones, and they're all coming together to form what?
One body.
Right? The imagery that Yechezkel is creating is a kibbutz, a gathering of exiles, right? A gathering of different people, right? What do we know is one of the causes for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? Sinas Chinam, right? Hatred, divisiveness, right? At this point in Jewish history, the Jewish people are spread out all over the place. Remember, the 10 lost tribes were exiled about 150 years earlier. Now you have the other two tribes who are now sent into exile. So what he's saying is, before Geula can come, before redemption can happen, what does there have to be? Unity. And again, that feeds perfectly into the next part of the Perek, which is, who do you have unity between? Yosef and Yehuda. The 10 lost tribes, the two southern tribes, again, those who learned Malachim know what I'm talking about now, right? That there's going to be a unification of the Jewish people. It's no longer going to be split up into Malchus Yehuda and Malchus Yisrael. It's going to be one people. All of this is part of the imagery that Yechezkel employs. All of it, as we'll see, is going to be significant in our study for Ezra Nehemiah, and all of it is extremely relatable to our contemporary situation of Shivat Zion, of our return to Zion. We have a few minutes left, and I promised you we will learn a little bit of Ezra, so let's jump right in. So now that we have the background, we have the emotional background of the Jewish people. Again, as implausible as bones coming back to life, that is how unrealistic it is to assume that God will actually return us to Zion after 70 years. And lo and behold, here we have Pasuk Aleph. Uveshnat achat lekoresh melech paras, lechlot devar adonai mipi Yirmiyahu. He fulfills the prophecy, or at the conclusion of the prophecy of Yirmiyahu. Again, the prophecy we're talking about here is Yirmiyahu says that after 70 years you're going to return. Okay? Who is the catalyst for the return? None other than a non-Jewish king. Okay? And what do we have? Oh, there's one more point I wanted to reference, but I'll do it at the end. Okay? Heir Adonai es ruach Koresh melech paras. God arouses the spirit of Koresh. Okay, again, we know that word ruach from Yechezkel, right? God is going to bring us back to life. Okay? Vayavor, vayaver, kol bechol machusov, vegam bemichtav lemor. An edict goes out. Ko amar Koresh melech paras. So says Koresh. Kol mamachot ha'aretz natan li Adonai Elohei HaShemayim. God has given me all of this. V'hu pakad alai livnot lo bayit b'Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda. And he commanded me to build his temple in Yerushalayim. Mi bachem b'chol amo yihi Elohav imo v'yal Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda. Anyone who wants, come up to Yerushalayim, build the Beis HaMikdash, v'yiven es Beis Anai Elohi Yisrael hu Elohim asher b'Yerushalayim. And you're welcome to come, to return, and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And what happens if you choose not to? V'chol hanishar b'chol hanukamos asher hugar sham. What if you can't? Let's say you're poor, right? Let's say you're unable to, you're infirm. So what is your job? Yinas uhu anshe mekomo b'chesed u'v'zahav u'v'rechush u'v'vehema. Right? Think about what we do in America. Right? What's the tagline of the FIDF? They protect us. Our job is to protect them. Right? That's basically what Koresh says. Right? If you can't come physically, then at least donate money. At least give your money and your resources to those who are choosing to do it. Similar to what we do nowadays. Iman edaval beis alim asher Yerushalayim. Vayakumu pasakei fai, vayakumu roshe ha'avot liyuda ubinyamin. The heads get up, vayakohanim, vayalevi'im, and the kohanim and levim, lechol ha'ir, Elohim es ruchol alos, livnos es beis anai asher Yerushalayim. Okay, and they take with them all of the gold and the silver that people had given to them to contribute to the Beis HaMikdash. Pasuk Zion, not only does Koresh talk the talk, but he walks the walk. V'hamelech Koresh hotzias klei Beis Adonai. He takes all of the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, okay, that were taken when they took the Jews out of Bavel, to Bavel, asher hotzi Nebuchadnezzar Yerushalayim, that Nebuchadnezzar are taken out of Yerushalayim, v'yitneim v'beis Elohav, v'yotzieim Koresh melech paras al yad mitradat had gizbar v'yisparim l'sheish batzar hanasi liyuda. And he gives it to Sheish Batzar. Now, who's Sheish Batzar? Who's Sheish Batzar? Now the answer is we don't know. Now the reason why that's important is because in a book that, as we'll see over the coming weeks, is going to give us a lot of genealogy. Okay, you're basically going to be on Ancestry.com for a lot of the books of Ezra Nehemiah. It is striking that we're told nothing about who Sheish Batzar is. Now, who could he be? So options in the Meforshim are, number one is he could be Zerubbabel. Right, that's what Ibn Ezra suggests. That's what Moshe Kimchi, who's the brother of Rav David Kimchi, the Radak, he suggests that it's Zerubbabel as well. One of the other ambiguities of who Zerubbabel is it calls him what? How does it refer to him? Nesi Yehuda, Prince of Yehuda. Is that the same thing of saying that he comes from the Davidic lineage? Well, no, but kind of. So it could be. So it's a little ambiguous. In other words, is Zerubbabel a religious leader? Because if he comes from Malchus Beis David, then he also has a religious component to him. Or is he merely a political leader? Which is another way that Nasi can be interpreted. Okay. What's also interesting, and what I think will give a little bit of insight and clue into this, is that Sheish Batzar appears one other time in the book of Ezra. And that is in the 5th chapter. You don't have it, but I'll read it to you. In the 16th verse, for those who want to look it up afterwards. And the verse says the following. Let me just find it.
Is it the
16. I'll read it in English. It says, then the Sheish Batzar came and set in place the walls of the temple of God, which is in Yerushalayim. From then until now, it has been under construction. So, what do they say Sheish Batzar did? He's the one who? He's the builder. He's the one who's overseeing the building of the Beis HaMikdash. On the other hand, in the book of Zechariah, now remember, what did I tell you? Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi are the Nevi'im. And they are the foil, so to speak, or the flip side of the coin to the book of Ezra, because Ezra is going to be more of a political book, and they're going to give more of the spiritual part. And part of the exciting part about learning this is contrasting them. And as we'll see, each book is going to highlight very different aspects of it. When Zechariah talks about that exact same thing, he says the following. Yedei Zerubbabel yistu habayis hazeh. The hand of Zerubbabel built this house, is building the Beis HaMikdash. So that's interesting. So now you have, in Zechariah, it tells us who's building? Zerubbabel. In Ezra, who does it tell us builds it? Sheshbatzar. Now, one could then say that they're the same person. Problem is that in that same parak in Ezra where we talked about Sheshbatzar, it also refers to Zerubbabel. So it's hard to assume that within the same chapter it would refer to the same person by two different names. That seems a little implausible. Now, if they're two different people, why would Zechariah highlight Zerubbabel, whereas Ezra would highlight Sheshbatzar? The answer perhaps is that they're two different people. But the reason why they're highlighted in two different places is because each book has a different focus. Okay, the book of Ezra in Nehemiah is focused on the political part of it. Right? Who initiates the return to Yerushalayim? Koresh, a foreign king. Okay, it's almost going to be told from his narrative. Sheshbatzar is most likely a Persian political appointee. Okay, the same way that Gedaliah was an appointee of Nebuchadnezzar. Right? We talk about Tzon Gedaliah. It was after Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. He had left a Jewish governor in Eretz Yisrael. That's why when Gedaliah is assassinated, that was the end of it. That's why we fast on Gedaliah. So we know that foreign kings oftentimes had appointed political, right? They couldn't be everywhere. They didn't have the internet. They couldn't get on a jet. So they had someone in charge. So Zerubbabel is appointed by, Sheshbatzar is appointed by the Persians. Zechariah has a totally different perspective. And that this is the theme that we're going to see over and over again. Zechariah, Haggai, Malachi, they're not interested in the political part of it. They're interested in the spiritual part of it. And when you talk from a spiritual perspective of the return to Yerushalayim, who are you interested in? Zerubbabel. Why are you interested in Zerubbabel? Because what does he come from? He comes from the Davidic dynasty. And when we're talking about returning to Yerushalayim, that connection to the Davidic dynasty is critically important. Because who only can be the king over a united Yerushalayim? Someone from Malchus Beis David. So I introduce you to this dispute over who Sheshbatzar is, because I think if we come to the resolution that we did, it actually introduces us to a theme that we're going to be seeing many, many times over the coming weeks, which is the contrast between the perspective of Ezra Nehemiah, or the books of Ezra Nehemiah, versus the perspectives of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And what we'll see is that they're coming from two very different perspectives. Each one has their agenda in the story, in the narrative that they tell. That is the backdrop, the despondent nature of the Jewish people that we saw today, right? How implausible it is to assume that we returned, and then we flipped on a dime, literally, into Koresh, all of a sudden telling the Jewish people in an inexplicable fashion, you can come back to the land of Israel. Okay? The Haftorah of the dry bones in Israel is read when? Well, it's read Pesach everywhere. They read it on Yom HaTzmaut as the transition point from Yom HaZikaron into Yom HaTzmaut. Many do, as the transition point from Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaTzmaut. Why? Because that's the story. Yom HaZikaron, those who died defending Israel, Yom HaTzmaut, the revival of the Jewish people. What better narrative to use it than the story of the dry bones? Next week we'll continue with the second chapter of Ezra Nehemiah, again delving both into the book of Ezra, but also into the book of Haggai. Everyone have a great week.